Welcome to Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson podcast that will keep you up to date on all things Rick Riordan and Rick Riordan Presents, including upcoming books, adaptations, and more. This is episode number 99. My name is Karen.
I'm Crispin.
Freaking out. Yes, I can't believe that next week is 100, but that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. This week we are discussing Red Pyramid Chapter 22. First, before getting into our Red Pyramid predictions, because after that, we will be stopping momentarily, I mean, for probably several months, our Red Pyramid discussion. We're putting it on hold so that we could talk about Chalice of the Gods, so this is kind of our last hurrah for Red Pyramid, probably this year, and then we'll probably get back to it next year.
2024!
Yeah, that's crazy to think about, but...
I know.
Yeah, so that's pretty exciting, and, you know, having 100 right around the corner is also very exciting. Mm-hmm. If you would like to tell us anything spoiler-free about the Red Pyramid, you can do so, and you can also send us ideas and stories that you want for us to discuss on our 100th episode. You can contact us at Prophecy Podcast on Twitter, at Prophecy Radio Podcast on Tumblr, Instagram, Threads, and Facebook, and Prophecy Radio Podcast at gmail.com. We do have some very exciting news this week, and I feel like it's only fair to let Kristen kick this off because she's the one who discovered it, and we were freaking out about it.
So I am a massive Survivor and Big Brother fan, and so I always get really excited when I know the new season's coming and we're going to get cast announcements, and I always, you know, you always look to see if there's somebody you might know, and Survivor and Big Brother have a tendency to, like, add one person who's kind of like either YouTube famous or someone you kind of recognize. And I hadn't heard of anyone that was going to fit that bill this time. So I was like, oh, you know, I'd like to see who the new cast is. And I get an email and it's got the cast of Survivor. And I scroll and I scroll. And whose face is there but Jay Maya, who we have had on the personal friend of the podcast.
Yeah.
Jay Maya, who's been on and who we are so excited to see is going to be on the season of Survivor. And I was already watching because I love Survivor, but I am so excited to see how she does and how it's all going to go. And, like, I can't wait.
Yeah, I am not a huge fan of Survivor, but I have watched, like, probably... My boyfriend is also a huge fan of Survivor, and so I used to, like, kind of chill and watch them while you were watching them sometimes. And then he was like, all right, I'm going to show you, like, the best seasons and stuff like that. So I've watched several seasons, the top-tier seasons and stuff, and got pretty into it. I mean, it is a very compelling show for a reason.
It's
been on for so long for a reason. And so he hasn't watched the last two seasons of Survivor, and I saw this, you texted me this, and I was like, I am watching, on the 27th we are watching every week, and I told him, I was like, you remember when we had Jay Maya on, she was the one who, like, sings about Percy Jackson and stuff, and he's like, yeah, and I was like, she's gonna be on Survivor, and we have to watch, and he's like, okay. So,
like, sounds good.
Yeah, I am so excited for her because I know that this is something that is right up her alley.
Oh, yeah.
And she's such an intelligent person, and she's also a very, like, nice, like, bubbly person. She's easy to talk to. I feel like that personality is gonna make her, like, really dangerous in the game because she's super friendly. She seems very, like, physically capable, and also she's super smart, and that is a good combination to have.
Absolutely.
And so I hope she goes really far.
Me too.
Oh my gosh, she wins it. Like, that would be just wild.
It would be crazy.
That would be really, really awesome. And so, yeah, we are definitely going to be cheering her on. I hope you guys, too. You can go listen to our episode with her. It was episode number 69. We did an interview with her. She talked about her music, and she also talked about Percy Jackson and the influence that it had on her and her music. And we talked about the music we wanted to see in the show as well, so you can listen to us discuss that. She had a lot of really good insight into it. And she's just super fun, and I'm so, so happy for her. I tweeted out about it because I really wanted Percy Jackson fandom to know that this was going on, and hopefully as it gets closer to the release date, which is on September 27th, is the premiere, hopefully more people will see what she's up to and, you know, watch it and everything. And she replied with, "I love Prophecy Podcast. Being a Percy Jackson fan was a huge part of why I decided to go on Survivor. There were so many moments where my internal monologue was, what would Annabeth Chase do? I can't believe I got to finally go on the quest I've been dreaming of." How cute is that?
That is so cute.
It's so cute.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love it.
I love it so much.
Yeah. So that's super, super exciting.
If you, like, want to see Jemaya in, like, all her Survivor glory, she has, like, an intro video. They always do an intro video for, like, each contestant. So, like, you just get a little taste of, like, what they're, you know, made of, like, what makes them them. And hers was very appropriate. Like, it just felt like her. I was, yeah, like, okay, this is awesome. Like,
yeah.
Because sometimes I feel like some personalities, they miss an aspect of it or such at before you, like, get on the show and start playing the game. Like, and so as some people start playing the game, you're like, oh, they came across as really ditzy, or they came across as really smart and they're actually making some really dumb moves, or, you know, like, stuff like that. Sometimes the videos don't really match up, but I feel like, having talked to her and, like, had a conversation, I feel like the video is very reminiscent of, like, her.
Yeah.
And so I'm really excited, because I'm hoping that just means good things. Like,
yeah,
they've got her character and, like, who she is down. So, like, sometimes on Survivor, like, it's you know, reality TV, but they have to, like, create storylines through the show as things are going on and as people change allegiances and all that. Like, they're following what the castaways do. So, like, you know, but they are creating a story from all the chaos that's going on. And so, yeah, I love when you have a clear picture of who somebody is before they start.
Yeah. I'll link to that video because you're right. I think it was very good to kind of show who she is. And also, I read, like, the EW article, the blurb about her. She answers, like, several questions and stuff like that. And I'm probably biased, but I thought, like, her answers were really compelling, and they were really like, yes, I am a good person to be on this show. I think that I can actually win it. Like, here's my story. Because, you know, if you listen to the interview, you know that she was going to go to Harvard Law and decided to become a musician instead. I mean, that's a pretty cool story.
Yeah.
I think that there's a lot of other lawyers on the show.
There have been, too.
Yeah, but, like, this season in particular, I think there's, like, two or three other ones.
Yeah.
And so I think it's really interesting that she might be able to, like, sneak under the radar. Like, she's got the mind for that, but people might look at her and go, oh, she's just a singer, you know?
Right.
Like, what is she going to bring to the table? She might be able to lay low and sneak up on them.
I like it. I like it.
I also wanted to mention that I finally ordered a couple of books off of Book Outlet, because you've been talking about them so much. I swear this is not, like, a paid
it's not advertisement. If they would like to sponsor us,
that would be
Book
fun.
Outlet.
Yeah.
We are addicted.
But I got the hardcover for the first Sarah book and the hardcover for Winston Chu for, like, $7 each. And those books are listed between, like, $18 to $20, so, like, that's a really good deal. And shipping did cost me, like, $6 because I didn't put enough in my cart, but you can get free shipping if you order enough.
It's only, like, $35
for free shipping,
which is really not terrible.
Yeah. But I really wanted those books, and I didn't want to wait anymore, so
I
just got
them.
Yeah, but, and then I checked again a couple days later, and different books were there in hardcover, which is what I'm trying to collect, so.
Yeah, they update them, like, every day. They don't add, like, a ton every day, but, like, they update it every day, so there may be one or two added, there may not be any, the next day there might be 12 added, you know, you never know.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I love keeping an eye on what's in there, like, just to see if there's, I just start filling a cart, and then as it gets to $35, I'm like, okay, am I allowed to order it yet? Like, can I do that?
Yeah.
I have to pull it back just a little bit, because lately I've been buying a lot of books.
Yeah, I'm trying really hard not to, because I have way too many as it is, and I need to get some of the ones off my shelf before I decide to add more.
Yeah.
But yeah. If you want to order some books, you can do that at Book Outlet, and I'll put a link to the website, and hopefully you find some stuff, you know, hopefully you find some Regret and Presents books that you want to pick up. Speaking of RRP. Of course, The Spirit Glass by Rajni Chakchi is out in the world now. We discussed that on last week's episode. In case you missed that, it was a really great discussion. And I think Raj actually listened to our episode.
I think so, too.
Because she tagged us on Instagram and was like, it was a really great discussion. I was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe you listened to it.
Thank you for listening.
That would be terrifying to me as an author to, like, listen to somebody talk about my book for an hour. And, you know, of course, we're always really positive and excitable and stuff. But, like, it would still be kind of hard to like... No, that's not what I meant with that or something.
You're
like
getting
that.
It all wrong.
Yeah, yeah. So that's really awesome that she listened to it, and that made me really, really happy.
Same.
Yeah. Sarah Boateng's Guide to Witchcraft and Mayhem by Roseanne A. Brown comes out on September 12th. That is very, very, very soon. Mm-hmm. And I did start it, and it's fantastic so far. Reed Riordan put up two articles, Meet Declan and Meet Auntie Effie. I never say aunt, I always say aunt, but I feel like when you say, like, auntie, it's gotta be auntie, like, it can't be, like, auntie.
Yeah, that auntie just sounds weird.
Yeah, but, like, Auntie Effie. But Declan, I've been so excited to meet Declan since the first book, because he was, like, Sarah was, like, frenemy, where you could totally tell she had a crush on him, but, like, she didn't even realize it.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, when you meet him in the book, it's pretty great, and I really like him so far, and I'm really excited to see where she ends up taking this.
Yeah.
I also wanted to mention, this is kind of last minute, but if you're in the DC area, there is an in-person event at Loyalty Books that she is going to be at. I retweeted it on Twitter, so hopefully you saw that, but yeah, if you're in the area and there are still tickets, you should definitely do that, because Rosie is, like, really awesome,
yeah.
And she's really fun to talk to.
Agreed.
And I will tease you with, there is a very great and specific Percy Jackson reference in the beginning of Sarah.
You tweeted and mentioned that there were Percy Jackson references being missed if you've missed, like, Rick Riordan Presents books altogether. And yes, we've definitely come across a couple throughout these series we've read, but since I knew you were reading Sarah, I was like, uh oh, there must be a big one. Like, there is.
It's pretty great. It's pretty funny. Yeah.
Looking forward to that.
Yeah. And The Sun and the Star is still number one on the New York Times bestsellers list. This is 18 weeks in a row. I know Mark is just ecstatic about this. I'm sure Rick is too, but Mark in particular, I know that they really appreciate all the love.
Does it ever become old hat to be number one?
Probably not.
Months on end. Like, I mean, I'm sure it is for Rick after all these years, but it has to be absolutely thrilling for Mark and still a little, you know, exciting for Rick.
Yeah. And especially since I think The Sun and the Star was, I mean, it's not a typical Percy Jackson book because it's about Nico. It is kind of a standalone novel. In a way, he was trying to do something new here.
Yeah.
And even though it was a fan favorite character and there was really no way it was going to bomb, you know, writing with a co-author and stuff, you never knew how people were going to take it. So I think that even he is probably still very excited about it being number one.
It is very true. And it's a very special book in so many ways, mm-hmm. for so many reasons. So I am really, really glad to see that it's still having all kinds of success.
Yeah. The last thing I wanted to talk about for news this week is the Chalice of the Gods book tour, which is, of course, kicking off on September 27th. So that's in a couple of weeks at this point. I will be at the Chicago show, just as a reminder, so you can come say hi to me. Closer to the show, I'll probably tweet something out and maybe put something on Instagram, but I'm much lazier about Instagram. Twitter is where to reach us, really. But
for now,
yeah, come say hi if you're there. But I wanted to mention that they announced that there will be special guests at each of the stops for the book tour. I was not expecting this, and I was not expecting it to be all of the Rick Riordan Presents authors. And this was so exciting. And there are so many other places that I wish I could have, like, gone to be able to see people, because you know that, I mean, if I could see Rosh again, that would be amazing. And even Roseanne, to meet her in person would be awesome. But The Los Angeles stop will have Stacey Lee. The Houston, Texas stop will have Roshni. The Austin, Texas stop will have JC Cervantes. The Chicago stop will have Daniel Jose Older. And the Portland, Maine stop will have Roseanne A. Brown. So I get to see Daniel Jose Older, which is going to be very exciting. The two of them together as storytellers, as creatives who are like really into the process of writing and talking about it and like kind of are old hats at this. I think it's going to be an excellent show.
Agreed. Yeah, I think they're going to be a fun pair.
Yeah. But all of these are going to be so, so awesome.
Yeah.
I hope that, you know, whoever gets to go to the other ones, let us know how it is. Let us know what's going on.
Yeah.
I just realized they spelled Roshni's last name wrong on the website. They missed an H, but that's okay. Mistakes happen.
Yes.
I just got distracted by that for a second. But yeah, we are doing things a little bit backwards this week. We're going to be talking about the Kane Chronicles first before we get into our discussion, because we figured if we're doing predictions, we should probably fit in our last chapter first. So
that probably makes more sense.
Yeah.
Rather than making predictions and then immediately
getting a new chapter.
Yeah. Like, I'm going to predict this. Hey, look at chapter 22 that we've already prepped. My prediction game drift. No, that's cheating and that's not okay. So yeah, we are going to talk about the Red Pyramid chapter 22 entitled Leroy Meets the Locker of Doom. Our brief recap: TSA is easier to get through when Bast flirts with the agents, and they do, and then Carter takes on the set animal single-handedly and is super impressive without even knowing. Yeah, it's surprisingly easy to get through airport security with a bird of prey, which I love that Carter kind of calls Sadie a bird of prey, because it's true, but, like, you don't think about it that way. Like, I know what a kite kind of looks like, you know, but, like, you don't really think about it, like, it's like a falcon kind of on your arm, you know, like, that can't be easy. But when Bast is flirting with people and distracting them, it makes it a lot easier.
I had to look up a kite because I actually didn't know what it looked like, and, yeah, you're right, it is definitely a bird of prey.
It's
looking a little...
Like, it's not like you've got, like, a little... cockatoo on your head or something. Like, no, it's like a bird. Like, it's a big bird that's very scary and can hunt and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know. Getting through security is not as hard as Carter thought it was going to be with this bird. Thanks to Bast, pretty much. And I loved the note that Bast must have stored her knives in the duet because she doesn't set off any alarms.
Yeah.
And he just assumed that she would, much like Carter did with the box at the end of the last chapter. She must have stored her knives away for safe travels. They get through security in a decent speed, pretty well. And as they're, like, finishing up, the set animal arrives. And you start to hear the chaos of it, like, terrorizing people in the lobby. And Carter just is like, his instinct is, I can handle this. You know, somebody has to deal with it. We can't just leave it to kill people and keep killing people while we escape. Like, something has to be done. So we start to hear people identifying it as a moose, which made me laugh. Because after the description from last time, I wouldn't have thought moose. But it's big enough that that's what humans have identified it as. And so now that one person has called it that, everyone will.
Mm-hmm.
And I really loved that idea. Like, Bast kind of tells Carter, like, yeah, you know, once one human identifies it as such, the rest will kind of fall in line. That's how it works. It's very reminiscent of The Mist, but, like, it's got a bit of a twist,
mm-hmm.
I think. And I just thought that was really well described. Very easy to kind of understand that's how it works.
Yeah, it's basically like pack mentality. Like, you just kind of go along with the flow. And I always, and I know I've mentioned this before, always think back to Buffy and, like, all the weird things that happen in Buffy and how they explain it away as a gas leak or, you know, some weird thing like that, because it's just so much easier to comprehend something that your brain can understand versus this mythological creature that honestly doesn't really look like any other animal you've seen before.
It doesn't. So Bast tries to convince Carter that they need to run, that it's, you know, fighting is not smart, you can't defeat it, there's no point in staying and fighting. But Carter just straight up says, no, like, I'm not doing this, I need to help these people, I'm not going anywhere. And he sends Bast with Sadie in kite form and tells her to get to the gate and he'll meet them there. And he's kind of like, and I really hope I will meet them there.
Yeah.
Because he's like, I know that this is like a doomed outing, but I have to do it. It's something I have to do.
I really liked this part because he specifically talks about how this is like his choice for the first time. It's not someone encouraging to fight. Like, he wants to do it. And I was just wondering, like, what does this actually mean? Is he becoming braver? Is this, like, Horace's influence? Is he changing for the good? Or is he becoming, like, more reckless? Like, could this be a bad thing?
It's definitely a good question. I think, personally, it definitely could be attributed to Horace. 100% a possibility. My brain, I wanted to just kind of say that, you know, they've been running and fighting and running and fighting and running and fighting for the last 22 chapters. And part of me just wants to believe that looking at this situation, seeing what was going on and saying, like, you know, prior to this, they haven't had to leave a creature with a group of innocent civilians. Like, they've been in the park where the civilians were free to run, you know what I mean? But, like, at the airport, you're kind of trapped.
Yeah.
And I liked that Carter, I thought it was just Carter being Carter saying, like, I'm not just going to leave. Like, these, they didn't choose this, and I'm not going to leave them all to just be slaughtered because this thing is trying to get to us and can't get through security. Which would be funny. Because I don't know if it would make it through security. But, like, yeah, I really just thought it was Carter kind of evolving and saying, like, you know what? I've had to fight. I've had to do this. I'm choosing to do it now. And that's just how, you know, like, this is my choice now. I'm doing it. I didn't necessarily think it had any other major influence. But you're 100% right that it could be Horace. You're 100% right that it could be just the magic in general kind of him becoming more acclimated to it and being willing to put himself in more and more reckless positions, too. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of possibilities here.
Yeah. I like the idea that he's, just as a person, is becoming more confident because he's gone up against creatures before. He survived. He realizes the power inside of him. And, you know, I think he's always been a good person who wants to, like, help other people. But now he actually can do something about it. And so he feels a responsibility to follow up on that. So,
yeah. Really cool. Bass takes off and runs for the gate. So then Carter is there. And rather than, like, going for the box that he put in the locker in the duet that we watched him do, he retrieves his sword that he lost at Luxor just out of the duet. Like, just sticks his hand in and basically, like, feels for it, calls for it, and it's there. And I just thought that was really cool.
That is really cool. You can tell, too, like, a lot of this is just instinctual stuff. And I think that it probably has something to do with Horace, but also just something to do with his lineage and the fact that, like, this is something that he was born to do, and I really like that idea.
And that was basically the last thing Bast saw before she ran and was, like, really impressed by his ability to pull that sword out of the duet. So, again, probably means something to do with his magic, being able to manipulate the duet and use it the way, you know, you're allowed and you can. Seeing Carter actually do it is starting to really show his proficiency and what he's capable of. Okay, so once Carter is on his own with the set animal, he gives it a nickname because he doesn't like set animal, so he starts calling it Leroy. And Leroy is not a huge fan of his name. So Leroy bites Carter. Carter, after this bite, is like, you can tell his whole, like, being and Horace inside of him. They're trying to help protect him and heal. So his little falcon aura forms around him, which we've seen before. And he uses that aura to fight the set animal. And there's a little girl on the ground in front of him who, like, yells, like, "Go, chicken man, go!" And I just die.
Yeah, it was funny.
Because, like, of course she would see, like, a chicken man. And that's what he described himself as in his ba. Mm-hmm. He described himself as, like, a chicken suit or, like, you know, like a chicken person. So it made me laugh that that's what she saw, too. Okay, so Carter then opens this locker once he's fighting the set animal, he's having some success, but not, like, major success because it can't be defeated. Once it has a goal, there's not a whole lot you can do to, like, distract it or anything like that. Carter gets the brilliant idea. If he can hide belongings in the Duat, why can't he trap this being in the Duat, just like he did everything else? So he mentally opens the locker with the combination he's given it, and he stretches it in his mind so that it can fit this animal, and then he shoves the set animal into this locker, closes it, locks it. Leroy, the set animal, is very surprised that Carter is capable of this. And it isn't until later when we're talking to Bass that we learn that it is actually pretty impressive. The creature disappears. The humans nearby are all curious where it went. Like, they don't actually see what happened. And before he can, like, be stopped by security or have to try and explain what happened, Carter throws his sword toward the ceiling, and it goes back into the Duat, which, again, it's just cool that he has this ability all of a sudden to really use the Duat to his most advantageous.
Yeah, because he just learned about the locker in the previous chapter, and he's already kind of got a hang of it.
Yeah, and this is just throwing it and trusting that it's going to go where he wants it to, and it's going to do what he needs it to do. It could have, like, gotten stuck in the ceiling or something, but it didn't. It did exactly as he intended, which is cool. And so he throws his sword and takes off running for his gate, and he reaches it just as they're closing the door to the plane. So he's able to get on, and he sits down next to Bast and describes to her what he just did. And Bast is really impressed, as well as a little concerned, because it takes a lot of strength to do what he just did with Leroy. Like, it's no small feat, and immediately upon, like, sitting down and describing all this to Bast, Carter starts to really show the wear. Like, he starts to get tired, and Bast tells him, like, you need to sleep. Like, you need to heal both the wound you have on your arm from the bite, as well as to, you know, replenish your energy and your magic stores that you've used up by doing all of this work. And so, yeah, Bast encourages Carter to sleep. He's really worried about Leroy returning, but Bast assures him that, like, once they're in the air, there's nothing to worry about and you need to get rest, and Carter, like, passes out. Once Carter's asleep, his Ba is completely restless, as you would expect, because this is a Rick Riordan book, and when you sleep as a demigod or magician, you never sleep peacefully.
Yeah.
That would be just too easy.
Pretty much. But this is prophecy count number 37.
Woohoo!
I had to go back. Yeah, I think I had to go back to, like, it might have been, like, in the 70s.
Oh, wow.
That we last did it. It's been a while.
It's, yeah.
Yeah.
We fell behind on our job.
But, yeah. But we are back. I'm pretty sure I counted correctly. This is prophecy count number 37. And hopefully I remember to keep track from here on out.
We will certainly do our best. And if we forget, feel free to call us out.
Yeah.
It's only fair.
Yeah.
Carter's Ba wakes him up, as we've seen before, he travels, and pretty soon he's hovering above Phoenix, Arizona. And as he's, like, hovering over the desert, he's looking down at this, like, craggy, rock-filled area, and there's this crevice between two boulders where there's this shimmer of, like, heat and light that he can see. And the human eye would miss it, but because it's his Ba, he obviously sees it. So he squeezes down into this crack, this crevice, and gets into the cavern that opens up once he gets through there, and he sees a giant pyramid under construction. And not only is it a giant pyramid, but it's a giant pyramid made of red limestone blocks, so it's, like, blood red and very scary looking.
Yeah, that would be intimidating.
Right, yeah. And there are demons cutting the red limestone into blocks, and the pyramid is coming together very, very quickly. Carter makes note that they're, like, using ancient tools. Like, they're using all the tools that would have been used to build the original pyramid, but because it's, like, demons and there's magic involved, it's going way faster than you could ever imagine the others took. There's a barge floating in midair above the pyramid, and on this barge, Carter sees two figures. One is a tall demon in leather armor, and the other is more of a burly man in red combat fatigues. Carter very skillfully and silently lands on the mast of the barge so that he can kind of listen in to what they're saying and get an idea of what's going on here. The man clearly has Seth's voice, so I'm pretty sure we're supposed to believe that this is Seth in a human form of one sort or another.
I should have picked this as my favorite line. I kind of forgot about it, to be honest. About him, like, where would he be hiding? In a volcano with his red combat fatigues? Like, that was really funny.
Love it. Yeah. I agree. And then the other guy, the demon, is the rooster-footed guy from before. I think when he says before, it's from, like, his very first visions.
Yeah, because they had the toad guy and the rooster guy, and the toad guy got, like, exploded or eaten or something.
Dissolved, whatever it was.
He's gone.
Yeah, poof, gone. But the rooster guy survived, and he's still there. The rooster guy is described as being, like, 7 foot tall, scarecrow thin, bird talons for feet. His head is, like, the skinless head of a cadaver with as a face with solid black eyes and fangs. And no.
No. That's all I have to say about that. No.
Just no. I don't want to envision it.
No, I don't either.
I don't want to really think that hard.
Nope.
I'll just stick with the rooster description.
Yeah. And I'm just picturing another chicken man.
What's that, like, really tall rooster guy from, like, Looney Tunes? Like,
oh, Foghorn Leghorn?
Is that him?
I think so.
It might be. Like, that's kind of what I picture. I know it's wrong, but I'm more than happy to picture that rather than this creepy head thing that I don't want to begin. We now know that this demon is the face of horror, which, yay! No, not yay. Not at all. And I kind of love that after we get the full name, Seth never refers to him as the face of horror again. He just becomes face. Which really just made me laugh. Seth tells Rooster Dude that he is, like, preparing for his enemies to arrive, and he describes they neutralized the Seth animal. So, Seth is aware that Carter has put the Seth animal in a place where he cannot be accessed by Seth anymore. So, like, that just seems, you know, the fact that Seth already has that information, already knows, like, we don't know exactly how the Seth animal and Seth are related. Like, I don't know if it's part
connected.
Of his soul.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's, like, spiritually they're connected or what. But Seth is...
Yeah, spies or something.
Right.
Yeah.
But Seth is very much aware of what Carter just did.
Yeah. And I also liked that Seth was like, I kind of underestimated my enemies. They're a little bit trickier than I thought they would be. And, you know, Seth just seems like a very intelligent and cunning adversary, and so I think it's kind of cool that he's not going to be underestimating his and these kids anymore.
Yeah,
which is not a good thing for Carter and Sadie.
No, it's not. I mean, I feel like it was easy to underestimate them before because I think even Seth knew that they didn't know anything.
Right.
They have very quickly learned a good amount about what they are and what they can do, and they're learning more every minute of every day that they're, you know, on this quest to find Seth. So I think it is very smart of him not to underestimate them from here on out because every minute of the day is bringing them more and more knowledge of what they're capable of. So Seth wants this blood red pyramid built by sunrise on his birthday so that it'll be done before his enemies arrive. And we know his enemies are basically Carter, Sadie, and Bast at this point, but specifically Carter and Sadie, I think. And this is all just so that he can do bad guy things.
Yeah.
Which include, quote unquote, making this the final and eternal tomb of Osiris.
Right.
Which obviously alarms Carter because he knows that his dad is hosting Osiris, that Julius is hosting Osiris. So if this is the final resting place of Osiris, this is where his dad, in that sarcophagus when he disappeared in London, this is where he is now. And I can't imagine how hard it was for Carter to just, like, sit there. I mean, I know it's his Ba, but, like, to not try and, like, get into the pyramid or look and find his dad or, you know, like, it has to be really hard for him to know, like, his dad's right there. Especially because even when he entered the cavern, he felt this energy coming from the pyramid. And initially when I started the chapter, I thought maybe he was just feeling that energy that, like, we felt from all the other monuments.
From, like, magic.
Yeah. I didn't think anything of it. I figured it was just, you know, a magical place, a magical thing. no, the pyramid specifically has Julius's energy, mm-hmm. which is why it felt so friendly and familiar to Carter. And that just broke my heart because yeah. that makes it that much harder to, like, want to leave. Even though, you know, Set is right in front of you telling you things that will be important for Bast and Sadie to know. He still knows, like, I have to get back and let them know all this stuff. And to be there and to be where your dad is, this person you're trying to save and help, like, it has to be really hard. The demon, the rooster guy, proposes creating more chaos energy by capturing more gods and doing the same thing to them, which would allow Set to be even more powerful. Set is kind of on board for this, except that the demon specifically mentions Nephthys by name, and it gets Face a kick in his chest, which knocks him back, and Set is not okay with mentioning Nephthys by name.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was really interested in this because Nephthys is his wife, but she also betrayed him because, you know, she tried to warn Osiris about what Set was up to, and I really wasn't sure if he was mad at first about Face mentioning his wife because it was like, you know, keep my wife's name out of your mouth. Or if it was like, you know, he's still mad at her. So it is very interesting. I kind of feel like she's going to be the reason why he kind of like comes around.
I do too. That's the impression I'm getting.
Yeah.
Set is agreeing with Rooster Dude after having kicked him in the chest and is saying, like, hey, I like this idea that will imprison all of my brothers and sisters and I will have all the power and it will be awesome.
I think that's so interesting that it wasn't his idea.
Yeah.
That's not what Set was going to do, and this kind of lower level demon is the one who gives him the idea. I wonder if this demon is like working with somebody else.
Well, my other thought was that, like, this is kind of a setup.
Yeah, that's what it feels like.
Well, no, a setup for Carter, because in the next moment, Set looks Carter in the face and is like, isn't that right, boy? So, like, part of me thinks Set wants Carter to think this is all being come up with right now. Mm-hmm. But what if it's been Set's plan all along and he has pyramids being built all around him for all the other gods and it's just a matter of trapping them?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I didn't know how to take this.
Yeah.
So, it's definitely worrisome.
I think I'm still, like, Set's gonna become an ally, so, like, somebody's gotta betray him again at some point, like, and there's gotta be a bigger bad, but maybe that's all wrong.
I mean, you're definitely not on the wrong track. Like, that's definitely a possibility.
Yeah.
I'm kind of with you, where I think, based on what Nut told us a couple of chapters ago, I really do think that Set is going to end this book by kind of making peace, enough peace, with his siblings and with Carter and Sadie, that he's willing to work with them in the future. Like, that's just where my brain wants to be. I don't know if it's true, but, you know, we'll get there. So, yeah, Set looks Carter straight in the face and says, isn't that right, boy? And in that moment, Carter realizes that Set has been aware he's been there the whole time. And Carter immediately tries to fly away, and his wings aren't working. And Set reaches out for him. And that's where the chapter ends. So we don't know if Carter escaped. And we're going to leave it there for the next 5 months.
Yeah. I didn't even think about that, honestly.
It's a little bit evil.
What a cliffhanger.
But it'll be fun to kind of jump back in when we do.
Yeah.
So that is where we are going to leave the Red Pyramid for right now. We do have some prediction stuff that we're going to get to in the next section of the podcast. But for now, we're going to do our favorite quotes and favorite moments from this chapter. Karen, what was yours?
Mine reads, the servant flinched. I guess his name was Face of Horror. I wondered how long it had taken his mom to think of that. Bob? No. Sam? No. How about Face of Horror?
It's a good one. It's a good one. Mine was, you know how hard it is to feel like an extreme falcon-headed combat machine when somebody calls you Chicken Man?
I really wanted that one, and I saw you already put it in there, so I'm glad at least one of us picked it.
It's just too good.
It was really good.
It's too good. And then our favorite moments. Karen, what was yours?
We already talked about mine pretty deeply. Mine was Carter being brave and wanting to save people. I just thought it was really lovely.
I definitely agree with you there. Mine was Carter sending the set animal to the duet. I just think it's so smart, and I'm so proud of him for, like, coming up with the idea, and it felt very, like, organic. I don't know if it's, like, him embracing his inner warrior and, like, coming really into tune with his magic and is just figuring it all out or what, but I was just really impressed with him in that moment, and I really, really liked it.
Yeah.
And that wraps up chapter 22. We will return to the Red Pyramid chapter discussions in the future. I'm really, really excited to get to Chalice of the Gods, though. So I think this is going to be a worthwhile experiment.
Yeah.
But we are not quite done with Red Pyramid yet, though, because we are going to talk about some predictions that we have. Now, this is more or less my predictions, because Karen has read the book, even if she doesn't remember, like, everything. So I think you were trying to avoid making, like, bold predictions. This is...
I am going to be completely honest. I don't remember anything else that happens in this book.
Well, that's
like,
cool.
Like, at all. So I am going in blind, pretty much the same as you are. But either way, like, I have a lot of questions and stuff where, like, I feel like maybe my hunches could be a little bit more spot on, because maybe it's, like, in the back of my mind, or the fact that we've been talking about Egyptian mythology kind of leads us to come to certain conclusions. But for the most part, yeah, I wanted to hear what you had to say. You picked out basically, like, specific characters that you thought where they would go, and then, so feel free to just run through those, and then I have some follow-up questions at the end.
Sounds good. Okay, so the first thing, as I was sitting down and just kind of, like, working through what I think could come next and what I think will happen at some point or anything like that, the first thing that popped in my head was this storyline with Carter, Sadie, and then their mom and dad. Julius, I think that storyline is kind of obvious, like, how that story is going to come to a head by the end of this book, because Julius is in peril. But when it comes to their mom, I feel like Sadie is going to have an experience with her mother much like Carter is having with Julius. Like, Sadie wasn't as close to her mom as Carter is with Julius because he spent so much time with his dad. That's absolutely fair. But I feel like before this book is done, Sadie's going to have some sort of interaction with her mom, whether it's a prophecy, like a vision in her sleep, or she gets the opportunity to reach into something and talk to her mom or something. I feel like there's a little bit of an imbalance with Carter and his dad, and then Sadie and her mom. And I really just think at some point that you're going to find that balance. Because we've learned too much and talked too much about her mom for her to not have any presence in this story. And so far, we haven't really had a massive, you know, presence of their mother, but I feel like there's something coming.
I think, I don't like saying this, but I think that their mom is dead and gone. I don't think that we're going to see her again in the present, but I do kind of feel like maybe there'll be a vision of the past, and so they'll kind of see something that allows them to connect with her or, like, gain new memories or learn more about, like, what she was after. And that could, like, kind of give them some peace. I think part of me is, like, I kind of hope that she comes back because it's really sad that their mom died the way that she did. And the other part is, like, actually, I kind of want there to be, like, consequences to their actions.
Agreed.
And for Julius to be the one to, like, rectify his relationship with his daughter especially. And also learn more about his son and, like, what he's capable of and them all being on the same page.
Yeah. No, I 100% could see that being how it plays out. Because there's definitely more unknown about their mom and Julius that we need to learn. But, like, yeah, I would be totally down for, like, some visions of the past. I mean, they've seen other visions of the past. So I don't see why that couldn't be a possibility. Yeah. So my second prediction involves Nephthys. And I say Nephthys et al. Because kind of that whole, like, Demon Days children group.
Right.
I think they are somehow going to be able to convince Set to stop this foolish thing he's up to. And eventually Set becomes a reluctant ally to a greater cause in the later books. Like, I think this book will end with them kind of making peace with Set somehow, and this whole uprising of Set's kind of being washed clean, and everyone's starting new except for Carter, who will not be fully convinced.
Yeah.
Which I 100% am behind, because Carter has watched Set do more than anybody else.
Right.
Like, Carter's more aware of exactly what's going on with Set than Sadie or Bast or anybody. So I just feel like he's the one who's going to be skeptical the longest. Mm-hmm. It's going to be the Harry to Seth's Snape.
Yeah. Yeah.
If that makes any sense.
It does. Yeah. I definitely agree with the Carter bit, because I think that, yeah, you're right. He has witnessed a lot more than anybody else. I almost wonder, because we know the next book is Throne of Fire, and, like, fire reminds me of Set, so I'm like, is he going to be, like, completely defeated and on their side by the end of this book? I don't know. I think by the third book he will be on their side, but I'm kind of leaning a little closer toward maybe by the end of this book, Osiris and Julius are back, and Nephthys maybe finds a host or something like that. Like, the other gods are out, they're walking amongst people, like, they're part of the game now against, you know, the house's wishes, but maybe the house admits that, you know, they have to work with the gods to stop Set. And then I think by the end of the second book, Set might end up being on their side. So I think it might take a little bit longer.
That's fair. That's fair. I could see that. But yeah, they're definitely going to be on that road by the end of this book. Yeah. That's what I feel like.
Only because I don't know who will be the bad guy in the second book. Like, if it's not Set and it's not Apophis, because we think Apophis will be the third book,
yeah,
who would be the bad guy in the second book? I'm not sure.
It's a good question.
Could it be, like, Ra? That would be kind of... I mean, Ra's, like, a good god, but he's also, like, the king god. And
it's kind of like Zeus.
Yeah, like, he could end up being kind of scary, so...
Yeah. Yeah. I could buy that. I could buy that. My third major prediction is that Amos dies either during the battle that's going to ensue, or is a sacrifice, or has to sacrifice himself, or something... Somehow, I just think Amos isn't going to make it out of the Red Pyramid, and that Julius will, thanks to Amos's death or sacrifice or whatever. There's this imbalance between the two of them, and Amos started this book being really, like, you could at least tell he was trying to be helpful. We don't yet know if it was truly him in his right mind, or if he was being used by Set or whatever. But, like, it at least felt like Amos was trying to be helpful to Carter and Sadie. And I could see if there's that, if there's just something in Amos that allows him to say, like, you know, I wasn't able to do more, I wasn't able to help, or he wasn't in his right mind to help them at the beginning because he was being controlled by Set, but in the end, here's what I can do. I am your uncle, I do care about you, and I want you to have your dad. Like, I really feel like Amos is just gonna make some big sacrifice.
I actually really like this prediction, and I kind of hope it does happen, because he was super sketchy, and I feel like there's a potential that he has done some bad things, and then to be able to make up for that with a sacrifice this big would be, like, tragic, but in a good way.
Yeah.
So, I'm on board for this.
And I mean, I took into account that this is a Rick Riordan book, and we know how Rick usually handles, like, big death and things like that. And, like, the first book of the King Chronicles series, like, first book of Percy, you don't lose any major characters. You don't, you know, like, there's not any, like, really major deaths in the first book. And honestly, it takes a little while to get to the first major death in the first five Percy books. But I feel like that's why this makes sense here. Is it's not a main, like, Amos is not a main character, but he is a central character. Like, he is really involved in the big plan going on.
Yeah.
And he's kind of at the center of everything that's been going on this whole time. So that's why I kind of feel like maybe it is the thing that could happen.
And plus, he's a character that we don't really care about too much, but his death will still emotionally impact Carter and Sadie, so...
Yeah.
It would make sense to have him on the chopping block, so to speak.
And then, if that was the case, would book two One, could it be about saving him? Two, maybe he's not dead. He just disappears and they think he's dead. And book two becomes about finding out what happened or, you know, something like that. I just feel like if Amos dies or disappears by the end of this book, that book two could have something to do with either getting vengeance for Amos or getting him back somehow. Mm-hmm. It sounds a little too much like, let's go to the underworld, which is, you know,
a go-to Greek
reference. Yeah. I don't know if in Egyptian mythology, if that's really, like, a prevalent theme. Like, let's go check out the underworld.
Yeah, death is definitely, like, a big thing.
Yeah.
And we know about, like, the weighing of the heart and stuff like that. So it's, I mean, it's possible.
But I don't necessarily think we need to go to the underworld for it to be a thing that we're investigating. Like,
yeah.
There could be things on Earth, other ways for magicians to kind of look into the world of the dead or whatever and try and figure out a way to get Amos back. So it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to the Egyptian underworld. It just means that they may have to look into it or something.
Yeah, he could be, like, lost in the Duat or something like that.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Okay. My fourth prediction involves Thoth. This is because we know that Carter and Sadie are heading to Thoth.
Right.
So we're about to go meet him. And I felt like I needed to have some sort of prediction about what Thoth is going to get up to when they actually get there. And my instinct, based on who Thoth is as a god, is that Thoth isn't going to take sides, but he's going to provide guidance to Carter and Sadie how best to restore the balance between order and chaos. Set has kind of thrown chaos into prevalence, and order has kind of gone by the wayside. And I think Thoth, more than anything, wants to keep that in balance so that things don't get out of hand on either side. There's not too much order, and the house is running things like an authoritarian, you know, state. And there's not too much chaos where everyone is afraid of everything and Set is just terrorizing the world. Mm-hmm. I think Thoth really wants that to be in balance. So I'm guessing that his guidance is going to be more about not killing Set, but getting Set to stop or figuring out a way to halt the things he's working on right now.
Yeah, I could definitely see that.
Five is the most general prediction I've ever made in my life. Some greater evil is unwittingly awakened, either by the end of this book or at the beginning of the next one. I'm guessing if Amos were to die, maybe it's in a way he goes into the Duat and it stirs something that was not previously awake.
Mm-hmm.
This is probably going to happen because we need a big bad for the third book.
Yeah.
It's got to be the biggest of big bads. And so at some point, greater evil has to awaken because
right.
They're not currently awake that we're aware of. So that's, I mean, it's very, very general, but it's clearly something that has to happen, right?
Yeah, I agree.
I had to have something about the next big bad or at least the final big bad,
mm-hmm.
because otherwise, what are we doing? You're predicting stuff. It's got to include big bad guys. It just has to. Okay, and I basically have one more thing because I had made all these predictions, and I was like, okay, that looks like a good set. Like, yeah, we ended with the big bad. Sounds good, yeah. And then I was like, but Zia.
Yeah.
I feel like we're probably getting to the chapters in Red Pyramid. Like, they're going to go visit Thoth, and then they're going to head to Set. And I feel like as they head to Set, that's where they're going to meet with Zia again. And Zia's going to be on the opposite side because she has to try and bring them in because the house has told her that. And so I'm really anxious, honestly, to find out what Zia is going to do. Ultimately, I think Zia is going to either go against the house before the end of the Red Pyramid, or she's going to be the one who convinces the House of Life that aligning with the gods is the only way to stop what's going on right now. And that by doing that, hopefully, it will mend some fences between the gods and the House of Life, and they will see that gods like Bast, Osiris, Horus, and Isis are not forces for chaos and are not quote-unquote evil. they want to restore the order that was there.
Right.
And I'm really, really hoping that Zia is going to kind of be the linchpin, that, like, she'll be the one who kind of is holding everything together.
Yeah. I think that makes sense, because I think that she does have some loyalty to Carter and Sadie more than anybody else in the house, but she also knows what the house is all about. So for her to be that, like, middle person, I think would make a lot of sense.
And, I mean, could this be triggered by Amos's sacrifice? Like, look what he was willing to do as a loyal member of the house to save his brother, who he knows is hosting Osiris. Like, he understood, why don't you? That kind of thing. Like,
yeah.
I think that could all be linked and kind of all happen in the same 10 chapters.
But yeah.
It's just one giant confrontation.
Yeah.
That pretty much wraps up my predictions, but Karen had some other things she wanted to talk about.
Yeah, I think I read through your predictions, and it kind of made me think of some other questions that I just wanted to discuss, and this one's kind of related to that. So, like, do you think by the end of this book that the house will accept Carter and Sadie, and that they will be a team against whatever is coming next?
I sort of think it's going to end more like a truce.
Mm.
Like, the house isn't going to love the fact that Carter and Sadie are hosting gods, and maybe even Julius, but I think it's going to be like a the enemy of my enemy is my friend kind of situation.
Yeah.
Where they're like, okay, for now, we do need you, and so we're going to allow you to be on Earth, and we're going to allow you to host these gods, and we're not going to do anything, but by the end, we have to come to a new understanding or something. Like, I think it's going to be a tentative truce.
Yeah. Do you think Desjardins will be at the head of that? Or do you think he's going to be, like, dead and that's the only reason why they come to this truce?
I mean, I think it would be really cool if somehow Zia were to, like, jump Desjardins in importance. Like,
yeah.
Because she's coming at things from a more, like, wholesome perspective, like, she's with her actual whole heart is leaning into doing what's best for the world. Maybe she will somehow ascend to be the one in charge and higher than Desjardins. I don't necessarily need him to die.
Yeah.
But I need him to get the heck out of the way.
Yeah. I think it would actually be more interesting if he didn't die and if he was forced to work with them. Because then he would have to look at his own prejudices. And I also think that, I mean, we're only halfway through this book, so there's still a lot of room here to, like, learn more about him. But I do feel like there's just a big gaping hole where, like, his background is. We learned a little bit a couple of chapters ago, but I feel like there's still a lot more going on with him.
I agree. I definitely agree. Desjardins is one we don't know enough about.
Yeah. We talked a lot about Amos making a sacrifice, but, and I hate to say this, what about Bast making a sacrifice by the end of the book? And maybe not even dying. Maybe she goes back in to fight whatever monster she was fighting.
I mean, yeah. I don't like it.
Yeah.
I really want Bast and Sadie to continue bonding. Like, you know, Bast has been watching over Sadie without Sadie's knowledge for a long time.
Yeah.
And, like, my heart wants them to continue to just bond and be there for each other because, you know, I don't know. I do think there's a very good possibility that Bast is not around for book 2 and or book 3. Like, there's definitely that possibility. But I'm not going to like it.
Yeah. I think it would be interesting if she wasn't around for book 2 and that was, like, part of their quest in book 2 was, like, trying to save her after everything she did for them.
That would be really... Yeah, I would definitely read that.
Yeah. For sure. Do you think Carter and Sadie will have trouble controlling the gods inside of them?
I'm starting to think that Sadie is going to.
Mm.
Carter seems to have a really good hold on what Horus is capable of. Like, he's not giving Horus more leash than Carter thinks he can handle. And so far, Carter seems to be able to really use the magic at his fingertips more intuitively than Sadie. Sadie kind of seems to get overwhelmed by the knowledge that she's capable of. Like, she doesn't know how she's doing things. It's just happening. And I feel like a lot of it is because Isis is just kind of saying, okay, here's all the power you need. And she shoves it at her without helping or explaining. Like, Horus is talking to Carter now, whereas Isis is being a little more standoffish. And I kind of feel like until we actually hear Sadie and Isis, like, talking, I feel like we're kind of at a loss to guess what ISIS is up to. So if I had to say, I would say Carter isn't going to have as much trouble, but Sadie may actually lose power, lose control of ISIS at one point or another.
If I were just looking at the gods, I would say, and I mean, this is just a weird assumption, but, like, Horus is potentially more dangerous and more, like, cunning than ISIS. I see ISIS as more like a mother goddess, so, like, I wouldn't expect her to kind of try to control Sadie that much. But I think you're right in terms of the two, like, magicians. I think Carter, even though the world of magic is new to both of them, Carter knows a lot already about the Egyptian world, whereas Sadie kind of keeps pushing it away. And I could see her going, okay, ISIS, you take over because I can't handle this anymore. And then Carter's going to have to figure out a way to bring her back into control.
Yeah, I could see it.
What is the importance of the boy Sadie keeps seeing? And do we think that it's Anubis, which we kind of talked about before, or possibly somebody else?
I mean, Anubis makes the most sense. I do not know. Mm. I do not know what this boy's presence really means. Yeah. Like, whether it's Anubis or not, will this boy be the way Sadie comes back after ISIS takes over? Like, will he be the person to kind of lure her back to her consciousness so that she can take back control of her own body? Like, that's a possibility. I could see why Rick would kind of sprinkle this boy into the story early to give Sadie someone in her mind that she's familiar with that could lead her out of darkness. Like, that totally makes a lot of sense to me, because otherwise I'm not 100% sure why he's there.
Yeah. I feel like if it is Anubis, he's related to death. So, you know, is somebody going to die? Is he going to be the person, almost like an angel of death, who, like, takes them away? Or is he going to help explain somebody's death to them? Like, if Amos does die, will he be there to kind of explain to him, like, where Amos went and that sort of thing? Or if you were thinking something with the underworld, like, this could be a transition into, you know, maybe the next book if they go to the underworld and, like, he plays a bigger part, but Rick just wanted to introduce him earlier in the story.
Or maybe this boy, whoever he is, Anubis or whatnot, is sent by their mom to, like, to talk to Sadie, like, to give Sadie the hints that she needs to become powerful and to really harness her magic. Like, I could see that being a through line too. Like, at some point this boy is like, yeah, I knew your mom. Like, I know your mom. She sent me here. And like, wait, hold on. I've seen you how many times and you've never told me you knew my mother, that she sent you to me? Like, yeah. You know, like, I could see that being a really interesting story.
The other big thing that I thought was interesting to talk about was what other gods we wanted to see in the book and, you know, the rest of this book and the next books, because we haven't seen Ra yet. And Ra is, like, the king of the gods.
He's the bread and butter of Egyptian gods.
So, like, he's pretty much everywhere. We haven't seen, you know, him at all. So I kind of want him to come in. I kind of feel like, you're right, he is giving me like Zeus vibes, where I feel like he's going to be more of an adversary, even though he's like the sun god and that should be like a pleasant thing. We also see that there's a real dichotomy with a lot of the gods and with, you know, the Egyptians' relationship to the sun and the desert and all of that. So,
like, if you remember the two sides of the river, and the one side of the river was basically a desert full of death.
Right.
Like, so while the sun is, you know, life, and we think of it as being good and full of happy life warmth, it also can mean extreme heat and death for Egypt. So, like, yeah, I could definitely see that.
And there are so many different aspects of each god, too. Like, we have Amun-Ra, and that is going to be kind of a different personality than just straight-up Ra. So, like, which version are we going to get? Maybe we end up getting, like, a harsher version than something else. I also thought Hathor would be cool to see, because she's a cow goddess, and I just think that would be, like, prime, like, Rick Riordan humor to have a cow goddess. And
oh, yeah.
I just keep picturing this, like, really, like, plump woman with, like, cow ears and, like,
Maybe like a cow print hoodie that yeah. she's like always wearing, or a dress something like
and
that.
And like
yeah.
her tail, and like I just think that would be really cute.
Yeah.
And then the other one I thought was actually a decent possibility was Geb, because that's Nut's husband, and Nut gave Sadie the letter to give to him, so we might end up seeing Geb at some point.
I think, I don't know if it's going to be by the end of Red Pyramid, but I think at some point in the trilogy, Geb and Nut are going to play a very significant role. I feel like there's a reason Sadie, in the middle of a chapter, was taken to visit Nut
yeah.
in the sky. And then we got the story of Nut and Geb and how they're separated, and we got a demonstration of what happens when Nut tries to descend to the Earth. Like,
right.
I really feel like that is going to either be solved so that Nut and Geb can be together, or we're going to get some sort of confrontation of that punishment and their separation.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think at some point we will see Geb. Whether it's by the end of Red Pyramid, I don't know, but I feel like there has to be some reconciliation or something going on between
yeah.
them.
And especially if Ra comes into this, because Ra was the one that didn't want her to have the kids
yeah.
and stopped all that from happening and kept them apart. So maybe I don't think that they'll come together, because that's going to be like, you know, in Greek mythology, like Atlas no longer needing to hold up the world. Like, it just doesn't really happen.
Right.
So they'll probably still be separated, but maybe there'll be more love letters. Or maybe they can, like, FaceTime or something.
Right. Like, yeah, some sort of compromise
yeah.
will be made that they can see each other 3 times a year or, you know, something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. My last big question was, if Julius returns, will he take both Carter and Sadie with him? Will Sadie ever see her grandparents again? Will they ever accept Carter? There's this family dynamic that, because Julius has been separated, we haven't really gotten a lot of answers to. And we know now that, you know, now that the siblings are together, they don't need to be separated anymore, because everything's kind of coming to fruition. So will Sadie be able to travel the world with Carter? Will the grandparents take Carter in for part of the year? Like, it could be really interesting.
I mean, we learned that Carter and Julius were traveling so much because they were avoiding the house.
Mm.
Because Julius was... He didn't actually have Osiris until he opened the stone.
Right.
But he was trying to free Osiris, was
mm-hmm.
like what they had been working on, and the house was against that, which is why he was kind of running from the
yeah.
house. So I would like to say that if there is this truce between the house and Carter and Sadie and Julius, hopefully, that they could actually live together somewhere, whether it's in Egypt so that they can continue their training and really learn what they need to know about the Egyptian gods, or whether it's in London so that she can see her grandparents on a regular basis, or I don't know if the grandparents would ever be welcoming of both Carter and Julius coming, like, to live with them or anything, but, like, I could even see something like that, like Sadie saying, listen, this is important to me. I know that all this stuff happened in the past, but I need them here, like, more than anything, and, like, maybe there's some peace made between them, too. I would love to see Red Pyramid end with Julius, Carter, and Sadie, like, making a home together. Because I don't think they need to travel to the ends of the Earth anymore all the time. Like, if they need to go on a quest all together, absolutely fine. But, like, I feel like they could and should maybe make a space for the three of them to be a family by the end. Maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know. That is a big question. I mean,
yeah.
as far as her grandparents, I really want them to eventually accept Carter. Like, it's
so tragic that they didn't.
Yeah, yeah. But I also understand, like, they haven't seen him. They don't know him. They don't know anything about what Carter and Julius have been up to. And if they don't like Julius, then they are basically judging Carter by Julius. And so I'm kind of hoping that maybe, yeah, maybe Sadie standing up for Carter and saying, like, he's staying or whatever will kind of get them to come around and they'll realize how wonderful Carter is. But yeah,
yeah,
I'd like to see them come around in the end too.
Yeah, so that's it for our predictions so far. You know, part of me is sorry that we're putting the book on hold, especially after the end of that chapter. Yeah. But the other part is just really excited to jump into Chalice of the Gods. If you have any spoiler-free predictions or questions you want us to discuss, we can still discuss them in feedback sections in the future, even if we're talking about Chalice of the Gods. So send them in, but please, please, please keep them spoiler-free for both our sake at this point, because I don't think I remember anything else that happens.
Yeah. Prophecy Radio is produced by Subjectify Media. Follow our website on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, and Instagram at Subjectify Media, or visit us at SubjectifyMedia.com. We are home to three other podcasts as well. Tune in to Rewatchable for in-depth discussions of your favorite canceled and cult classic TV shows, such as Firefly, Veronica Mars, Avatar The Last Airbender, Buffy, Angel, and more. Not About the Weather is a general interest show that sometimes features interviews with our favorite creators. And Not Another Teen Wolf podcast features interviews with the cast and creators and has discussed every episode of the show, as well as the movie, and Jeff Davis's new show Wolfpack is currently getting the same treatment. You can contact Prophecy Radio directly on Twitter at Prophecy Podcast or on Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr at Prophecy Radio Podcast. You can also email us your long-form thoughts to prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. You can find us and our episodes on Spotify, Apple, or any of your favorite podcast platforms. Please consider leaving us a review or a rating. 5-star reviews help others to find us, and we really appreciate that. You can leave us questions, comments, ideas for episodes or content you want to hear from us. We love hearing from you guys. We try to respond and reach out as much as possible, but for those that we miss, we love our feedback section as well. Karen had a nice exchange with Ian this week talking about the spirit glass, and so I'm going to throw it to her to look at this Twitter exchange.
Yeah, I basically just tweeted out my review of the spirit glass, which is on Subjectify Media. It is spoiler-free, so you can go read that if you haven't had a chance to pick up the book yet. And Ian at @ensign_Davies said, "Great review. I don't suppose you've seen a release date for the UK. I can't seem to find one." And I went looking too, and I said, "I'm not seeing a specific date either, though I did find it on Amazon UK." And he responded and said, "I saw that. It's imported from the US. I usually read on my Kindle, which you would think would be easier to import. Thanks for looking. Maybe I should read Arusha while I wait," which, I mean, I completely agree. You should read Arusha. And I tagged Becky and Stephanie Laurie in a tweet because I was wondering about this as well. And Becky said that the RRP authors, as part of their arrangement with Rigaround Presents, are free to contract other English language, foreign language contracts, film rights, etc. Those are not included in their contract with Rigaround Presents, and why there is no Rigaround Presents outside of the US and Canada.
Good to know.
So everything that you see in the UK is probably, unless they've had like different arrangements, is going to have the U.S. cover and basically be imported from the U.S., which is why Sarwat was talking about how Fury of the Dragon Goddess was in the U.S. and he wasn't even able to get copies in the U.K., so that explains that. And it would be really cool to get, like, U.K. covers and stuff for all the RRP stuff, but I can understand, too, why that might not be entirely possible. However, I did also see that Becky tweeted today that Forbidden Planet in the U.K. does have a lot of the Rigaround Presents books. They are, obviously, the U.S. covers and everything like that, but if you're really looking for a physical copy and cannot find one, you could either buy on Amazon, and I can put in the link for the Spirit Glass, or you can maybe go to a Forbidden Planet and find them there.
Also worth noting, if you are making hay about it on the internet and talking about how you would like a UK edition of Spirit Glass, that's how these publishing houses take on books from other countries in the first place. Like, I mean, a lot of it is the author saying, like, "Hey, I have readers who want my book in, you know, published in the UK. They want it published in the Philippines. They want it published, you know, wherever." A lot of it is reader interest that kind of drives some of that, and it either drives the author to want to find a publisher, or it drives a publisher to want to pick up a book in another country. So making hay about it online is not a bad idea. You know, talk about how you really want a UK addition of the spirit glass, and hopefully maybe it could be something that could come to fruition in the future. I mean, it would be a little while down the road because it takes time to do all that, right. But at least, you know, eventually you'd have one.
Yeah.
And Forbidden Planet, I know, does a lot of, like, signed copies and stuff, so,
yeah,
they definitely have, like, a good selection, so that is nice to know that there is somewhere to get them. It's just maybe a little harder than over here in the States.
Right.
Okay, and that pretty much wraps us up here. Next week, we will be celebrating episode 100 and doing a Chalice of the Gods character catch-up. We decided, since it's been a while and we want to kind of get back into that Percy mindset and remember where these characters are going to be starting at the beginning of Chalice of the Gods, that we would do a character catch-up next time, just kind of a refresher and a reminder of everything that's gone on up to where this book is going to start. And I think that's really smart because I don't remember a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
My brain only has so much room, and it keeps trying to make room for new things. So I think this will be a really valuable asset before we start reading Chalice of the Gods in episode 102. You know, we've got all kinds of things planned, so it'll be fun. And I'm looking forward to celebrating 100 episodes.
Yeah.
That's crazy. I'm sorry, it's crazy. Anyway, until then, this is Kristen.
And I'm Karen.
And we're Prophecy Radio, signing off. Over and out.